Hey, welcome to the podcast. I'm Joe. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're going to be talking today to music legend David Byrne of the Talking Heads fame. And he's an artist who's put together a spellbinding musical experience on Broadway that's called American Utopia. And I'm going to be talking to him about that in a minute. And I'm going to be asking him how he considers the fact that he's on the spectrum with Asperger's, how he considers that to be a superpower. I heard him say that in a recent interview, and I find that fascinating because I have a son with Asperger's as well. We're also going to explore how he became one of rock music's most influential forces after just his mesmerizing debut at CBGB's in the 70s, because he's like this shy, reserved kid. That's how he describes himself, who viewed himself as an insecure outsider. And I want to know how he could step onto stage from the start and transform himself into this otherworldly rock figure who could take his audiences on this spellbinding musical journey, whether it was just a handful of people 40 years ago at a downtown dive in New York City, or sold-out Talking Heads tours in the 1980s, or standing-room-only performances now on Broadway with American Utopia. And I've really always been fascinated by David Byrne and his ability to make that transformation on stage so effortlessly and so seamlessly. He's always reminded me of David Bowie, who could morph from being this short English kid into Ziggy Stardust, Major Tom, the man who fell to earth, the thin white Duke, the soul man, and you know all the personas that he so easily slipped into and slipped out of. David Byrne could do that too, and I'm fascinated by his similar talent because, you know, it's something I've always been so terrible at doing myself when I was trying to be a musician. And I'd step onto stage at a club or a bar, and somehow, I don't know how I could do this, but somehow I became even more boring, even more middle class, even more pedestrian when I tried to talk to people with a guitar hanging around my neck. Any ability to speak like I could do as a politician in two-hour debates, or any ability to move from one subject to another like I could do as a news host in a daily three-hour news show, it completely vaporizes into thin air when I'm on stage playing music. And I instantly became mute. So yeah, maybe I'm amazed. Maybe I'm amazed, just like I've always been amazed at athletes like Hank Aaron and Tom Brady and Kobe Bryant, who could do things that seemed so impossible to do for mere mortals. One other quick thing about David Byrne's career, and then I want to get to him. He's going to be with us in 1 minute. And one thing that I can learn from, and that's his ability to remain still. Byrne has always been an American original, and he's a guy who would rather do nothing artistically than trod down a path, a musical path that's already been worn down. You know, the Talking Heads were unique from the start, unique in every way. And so, too, is American Utopia. But it was David's first work in almost a decade because he wanted to say something only when he had something new to say. And I don't know about you, but so often I try to stay in motion. I try to add on to projects. I try to look over to the horizon to what I'm going to do next, instead of focusing on where I am right now. Obviously, I'm not good at following lessons from the gospel according to Yoda, being present in the now, slowing my mind down, making the most of the moment, and doing what I'm doing now, instead of quickly darting to the next project, the next job, the next idea, and speaking only when I have something important to say, which David Byrne does, and that's why we're so excited to have him on the show right now. Oh, it's a great honor to welcome David Byrne to our show. And David, thank you so much for being here. When I saw the movie during the pandemic, so much of it, of course, has to do with the human brain and making connections. And there's a line, because I have a son with Asperger's, there's a line in there where you say, meeting people is hard. and then you go and you talk about how some people meet on dating apps and how some people are just confident and go out there with swagger. And the thing I felt most remarkable about American Utopia was that, you know, I've been a rock fan my entire life. Music's at the center of my life. I've got to say, I've never seen a performance where a performer makes a more intimate connection with the audience. And I sat there thinking, this is coming from a guy who was thinking about calling one of his earlier bands the Autistics. I mean, what a remarkable leap for you over your career. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah, I can talk about that. Part of the show is approaching all the various things that we're dealing with in the world. Part of it is doing that through my own kind of personal journey, which is maybe a little bit unique, but I think a lot of it has things in common that a lot of people go through. I felt a little awkward socially as a younger person. I felt awkward talking to people, getting to know people, especially talking to strangers. That was really difficult. And I didn't see it as a handicap. It all worked out fine, of course. But I noticed that other people were different. The other people were different than me. And then gradually over the years, thanks to maybe being surrounded by band members that I worked with, colleagues, being more comfortable around people, I kind of came out a little bit that way, became a little bit more comfortable talking to people. Now I say hi to people all the time, and sometimes they give me a look like, who's this guy? Well, who's this person? Do I know you? Yeah.
It's quite a change. I saw in an earlier interview, you said before that you thought you had a slight case of Asperger's, but said it was almost like a superpower, and it's so interesting. My son and I talk about this, and he goes through all the people who have Asperger's and how successful they've been, and talks about how it can be help with a certain amount of focus. Have you found that creatively in your life as well?
Absolutely. In retrospect, of course, when I was younger, the idea of this spectrum that included the Asperger's spectrum wasn't really discussed that much. I just thought, well, I'm a little more uncomfortable around people than some of my friends are, so I'll hang out with the ones that are socially adept, and I'll just kind of hang on to their coats and kind of get whatever. But yes, it meant that it's a kind of thing where, yes, I can have a lot of focus. If I wanted to draw something or paint something or write something or work on songs, learn guitar, I could just like focus on that and close everything else off, shut out the rest of the world. So that became, yes, a kind of superpower that I could do that. It's a little bit reminiscent of what we've been going through for the last year and a half, being kind of isolated. But of course, at that time, I didn't see it as being forced isolation. I saw it as, oh, I just want to focus on this. I love doing this. And I'm going to just focus on that.
Stay at it. You know, there's as you, of course, know, because you wrote the book, in How Music Works, you talk about how there was a British study that said a certain percentage of people that were very successful had challenges, whether they were on the spectrum or had other challenges that made them possibly see the world differently. And I really saw that firsthand in American Utopia when you explained to the audience that everybody's coming over to my house. It seems like such a joyous concept, right? But it's really more of a threat, more of a, oh my God, they're coming, which by the way, unfortunately, that's how I look at it. Oh my God, they're coming over here and they're never going to leave. You tell this really moving story of a choir that you contacted. They sang it without changing any words and changed the entire meaning, which sort of goes along with your book as well. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'd written this song. And of course, coming from me, a song called Everybody's Coming to My House is like slightly terrifying. somebody who is a little bit socially kind of uncomfortable. It's like, oh man, what do I do now? And when are they going to leave? And then I invited this choir, a high school choir in Detroit, to sing and interpret the song. And as you said, they didn't change a word, but somehow their interpretation gave the song a completely different meaning. It gave it this sense of invitation and openness and inclusion that was maybe absent in my interpretation, but the way they did it. And I realized that, yeah, that the meaning of a song can be completely changed depending on how it's performed.
Yeah, and you, of course, talk about that in your book. And also, of course, we see so much of that in American Utopia. The one thing that kept hitting me over and over again throughout the performance was how liberating it all was. I remember first seeing it, seeing you perform on Saturday Night Live from American Utopia, and said David Byrne was going to be on. I said, okay, well, that's, yeah, fantastic, great. I love him, he's great. And suddenly, you show up on stage, and it was extraordinary. It was something I'd never seen before. It was so liberating. Those stacks of amps, liberated from the tangle and the mesh of wires, from the huge drum kits, from even the shoes. Can you tell us, where did the concept come from? You would think somebody would have cracked that code over the 50 or 60 years of rock history, that somebody else would have done that effectively, but it really was groundbreaking.
Yeah, I had an idea before this all started, and I asked myself, what if we were all wireless? What if nobody was tethered with cables or anchored to a drum kit or a keyboard or anything like that, that they carried everything around like a marching band or something like that? And I wondered if that was possible. And with recent technology, yeah, it is possible. So I thought, okay, that's what we're going to do. And yes, I was kind of surprised. I thought, wait a minute, nobody's done this before? Really? Really? Nobody's done this before? And, well, not that I know of. Nobody's pointed it out to me. So, yes, we had to take the drum kit, what would be a drum kit, and break it down into six different parts. So we have six different drummers playing what amounts to a drum kit and percussion. And everybody else is wireless. So, it's completely liberating. It means that the only thing you see on stage is us. You don't see amps and cables and giant instruments and all kinds of stuff. It's just us. And I realized that, wow, that's what, yes, that's what we're interested in.
Yeah.
We don't go to a show to look at amps. We go to a show to look at the people, to look at the performance and see what they're doing and how they relate to us and how they relate to one another. And I thought, well, this is going to make that even more obvious.
Really, it adds to the intimacy, it adds to the connectivity, and it is a long way, a very long way from CBGB's in the mid-70s. There was a line that you quoted in your book that I just absolutely loved. You said, I wouldn't call what we did then entertainment, but it was riveting in its own disturbing way, not quite looking like an accident, as one writer said, but not that far off from it either. It seems that, and I'm just curious, as a kid who never dreamed of being a rock star, like so many of us did, something happened, you moved into it. Can you explain what separated you from so many other people, that when you stepped onto that stage, you would have a persona that really separated yourself from who you were off the stage and was something visually compelling that people wanted to see from the very beginning?
Looking back, in retrospect, I realized that, again, my kind of discomfort in kind of social situations was actually helpful this way, too. That it meant that in order to communicate to people and in order to kind of put my existence in front of people and address the things that were interesting me, I kind of had to get up on stage. And I could do that. Somehow, it doesn't seem to make sense, but it does actually make sense. Somehow, I could step on stage, be another person, and really put myself out there. And then the minute I stepped back off stage, I could retreat into my shell, sort of. But that way, it gave me an outlet. It gave me a way of talking about whatever I wanted to talk about, although it was all in songs, to kind of announce my existence, like, here I am, I'm a person. So it was sort of an act of desperation. I think maybe people who saw those performances realize that. Like, this is a guy who has to do this. This is not just like, I feel like writing songs. This is kind of like, he has to do this.
Now, you talked, though, about how you could never even imagine that you would do this as a livelihood, that you would never step on the stage like The Who or other giant bands. In your book, you talk about how soul-crushing and discouraging it was to see James Brown. I think you said it was in Providence. You saw James Brown. He was so extraordinary that you actually walked away from it and said, well, that ain't happening. I could never do that. And yet you did.
Well, I didn't do anything quite like that. But yes, once I thought that people that I saw, entertainers that I saw, singers and entertainers, they were extraordinarily gifted. Some of them had spent years honing their talent and their craft, or maybe they went to music schools, or they spent years learning how to play in a kind of virtuosic kind of way. And I thought, I don't do that. I haven't had that kind of background. I can't dream that could happen to me. But I still enjoyed playing and performing. I could do that as well. So, and yeah, and like when I saw that James Brown show, I realized, of course, I could never do that. But maybe there's something else that I can do that comes out of me where I'm not trying to be somebody else. I'm not trying to take somebody else's moves or somebody else's vocal attitudes or anything like that, and that I can discover something that is unique to my own world.
And you talk about that in the book as well, that you've seen, unfortunately, so many artists that have tried to go on stage, emulate somebody else. They're not as good versions of that person. And somebody's already been there. Somebody's already done that. And it seems you look at your career, and it seems like that's really been a North Star for you all along. Be yourself, constantly push, and try to do something that nobody else has ever done.
Thank you. Yes. Sometimes that means not doing anything until you figure out, okay, how am I going to move? What kind of movement am I going to do? And I realize that, well, better not to do anything than to do something that you're just kind of borrowing from somebody else or appropriating somebody else's moves. Wait until you figure out how you can do it in your own way and something that belongs to you. So sometimes it meant like not doing anything until you're really ready.
Yeah. Can I ask you one more thing about your musical development that I was absolutely fascinated by? As a songwriter, a very bad songwriter, one of the most glorious days of my life as a teenager was when somebody sold me an old beat up Teac A3340. And it was, for those who don't know, I mean, there are a lot of people that don't even know what reel to reels are. It was a multi-track recorder. And I read that your father used his engineering skills to help make your own multi-track recorder. Is that right?
Yes. And what my father helped me do, or what he did, he adjusted our tape recorder. We had just a reel-to-reel tape recorder in the house. And he adjusted it so that you could record what was called sound on sound. So you could play something that was on the tape, play along with it, and then it would record that on the tape, and in the process, destroy whatever existed on the tape. Mm-hmm. So if you made a mistake, you'd basically have to start from scratch. But it was thrilling. I could kind of very carefully build up things and do primitive overdubbing and things like that, which was really exciting and was a really generous thing that my father did.
Yeah.
They never pushed me to kind of take music lessons or anything like that, but obviously in ways like that, they encouraged my curiosity.
Yeah, it is. What a wonderful gift that a father could give his son. I found so many of your arguments so compelling, not arguments, but discussions during the show, so compelling on politics and getting involved. And I love that you actually focused on local elections, because people don't understand how important local elections are. Only 20%, as you said in the show, seem to participate in there. Most of them are older. Talk about how important it is and how much you're going to be talking about that moving forward for people to get involved, get registered, vote, make a difference.
Wow. Well, okay. We like to think of ourselves as a democracy, and one part of being a democracy, it's not the only part, but one part is that we as citizens get to elect and vote and choose our representatives. But when only 20% of us show up to make that choice, which isn't the case in a lot of local elections, then it seems like, what kind of democracy is this? 20% deciding who will represent 100%, that's not really democracy. We got to get everybody out there. Everybody who's registered to vote needs to show up to help make these choices, because it's not something that everybody in the world can do. We have worked very hard to get to this position, and it's a hard thing to continue. I mean, there's always efforts at voter suppression. They've never ended. But as long as we can keep being engaged, then we can kind of resist that and find that we hope, the goal is that our representatives truly do represent what we would like.
Yeah. You know, I've had people ask me at times what I do, and I say, well, I've spent most of my adult life telling people everything's going to be okay. When Democrats win, I have to tell my Republican friends, we're a democracy, they've got 2 years, we're going to be okay. When Republicans win, I tell my Democratic friends the same thing. That shtick has grown a little stale over the past 2 or 3 years, and I have found myself at times not able to deliver the message I've delivered to friends and family for the past 30 years. And yet, in this visually dazzling, just spectacular show that you put on, you choose at the end to strip everything down and basically go a cappella and talk about hope. And you talk about one fine day, that things can get better. So let me ask you, how do you remain optimistic? And are you still as optimistic today as you were a few years ago?
Wow. Like, I think like a lot of us, and this includes people from all parts of the political spectrum, I wake up and read the papers and I get kind of angry and annoyed and anxious and frustrated, all that sort of thing, just like anybody else. But I've also made an effort to try and hold on to some kind of hope that things are improving in some ways and in some sections. We have a bias towards negative news. We just focus on it. If there's negative news out there, it's more popular, it gets passed around more often. And yet there are positive things going on. That's not to say that everything's going to be all right and we don't have to do anything, but there is cause for hope, and we are maybe better than we think we are.
Before we go, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Spike Lee's name. Because I wanted to ask you, because you've been collaborating with people, and you always seem to find just the perfect person for each project you do. And you chose Spike, who I must say, I wouldn't have thought, well, this is the first person I would go to. But you chose Spike, and the way he set things up, and I can't wait to see the show live, but your extraordinary lighting, your extraordinary choreography, everything that's so extraordinary visually about it, Spike actually, there was value-added shots above and from behind, and then, of course, when he put all the names on the screen. Talk about working with Spike Lee and what that partnership added to American Utopia.
I'd kind of known Spike a little bit for many years, for decades, I guess. We came up along around the same time in New York, but we'd never really done anything together. But this seemed like the thing where I just thought, I think he'll get this. I think he'll get this. He knows how to do this. He's an incredible filmmaker. He's captured shows before, so he knows how to do that, which is different than doing a dramatic work. And so I invited him to come and see the show, and he said yes. And the way he captured it, it was just incredible. Yes, as you say, there's shots from above, from behind. There's cameras that you don't see, but that are moving around with the band on stage. So it gives you more than what you get as an audience member. And of course, as an audience member, you're getting kind of a live thing as it happens, but this is coming, giving you positions from on the stage. You're kind of immersed in with the band, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, well, David Byrne, thank you so much. It's been a joy listening to you through the years, watching you through the years, and it's been great having you here today. We're very thankful you took time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I've got Mika Brzezinski with me now, somebody
Hi.
That you know, somebody I know even better. But Mika, how great was it listening to David Byrne?
Well, what was so great about it is I could just tell how much you loved it. You connected with him on so many levels, and there's so many things that absolutely fascinate us, but especially you, about what it takes for him to really connect. And a lot of it is on stage.
Yeah, so much of it's on stage. I also, it's very interesting when I see somebody like David Byrne, and I mean, this is a total compliment to him. I see somebody like him, he reminds me of your mom, who, for people that don't know, has been an artist her entire life. She's been a sculptor, looks at the world differently. That was one of the fascinating things about your father. Your father helped run foreign policy for the United States and had to be so immersed in the world. Your mother, though, was an artist who sort of carved out her own world.
What an interesting parallel. But yes, I see it. I mean, my mother is an artist. She's a sculptor. And she is deeply immersed in not only the work and the progression of her work and the arc of her work, but its connection to nature. And it really actually separated her from, I would say, like, normal social life, quite honestly.
I mean throughout... you said sometimes you actually were embarrassed at times.
Well, we're all
as
embarrassed.
A kid. As a kid, because she was an artist,
yeah.
And you had all of these very middle-class kids with middle-class values. Your mom, though, she looked at the world differently.
So this is what I mean. We're all embarrassed by our moms and dads at some point, but like my mom, because of her obsession with her art and how much it drove her, she would like for 6 or 7 hours, whatever she could get, if she would get that time when we're all at school, just immerse herself, dive into a relationship with a tree trunk and a chainsaw. And if she found her way that day, and then she had to put everything down and come pick me up, chances are she would show up at my school in a jumpsuit, covered in sweat, covered in sawdust stuck to her face, and she wouldn't even know it because she was just so busy getting there to pick me up and so anxious to get right back and get right into that moment with her art. And I didn't appreciate it. Looking back, I kind of do. Looking back,
pretty remarkable.
She's really cool. Yeah.
But I would guess with your father being at the center of power in Washington, D.C., being the national security advisor, running foreign policy, I would guess there were some times that there were some social hiccups there.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes she would go to the White House with sawdust actually in her hair. I thought it was the new trend. She wanted to keep, well, it was who she was, her art. And so there were a lot of social hiccups, a funny meeting with the Pope where my mother would just be incredibly blunt. And she brought her art or her sensibility with her wherever she was. And that's what I mean about that disconnect. I mean, there were times I saw her not completely relate the way other people do, but it's also what made people love her so much, what made her so interesting, what makes her still today so enchanting, really.
Yeah. Now, you talked about your mom showing up with sawdust all over her when
just
she picked
in her
you
hair.
Up at school.
Oh, at school, yeah, all
at
over.
Sawdust at White mm-hmm. House receptions. And again, I think the cool thing is she didn't care. Your dad didn't care. People knew she was an artist. And it actually made her, made people love her more and more special. But one time, you guys made the newspaper because of her, the fact that she just looked at the world differently. She was not caught up in impressing official Washington. And you talk about one time where she showed up with more than just sawdust on her work outfit.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm going to share two times. One time where she traumatized what I was hoping would be my best friend. But I'll start with that moment, Joe. She showed up not only with sawdust all over her jumpsuit, her zip-up Air Force uniform that she got as a gift that became her artist's jumpsuit. And she had the sawdust in her hair. And my mother was covered, and I mean covered, with blood. She had blood all over her front.
Well, that doesn't
and
happen.
And on her hands. And she was driving our big family car. It was a station wagon. And I didn't even, you know what? I didn't even miss a beat. I was just like, hi, Mom, got in the car. Like, what has she been up to today? So I'm sure everybody around me at the Madeira school was a little like, who is the woman covered with blood picking up Mika Brzezinski? But I just got in the car, and I could tell it wasn't just me and my mom in that car. It wasn't.
This is starting to sound like one of those crime podcasts, so keep going.
Yes, we were not alone. No, honestly, it was me, her, and I felt like I needed to look in the back of the car. And I turned my head, and before I even completely turned around in my peripheral vision, I could see a hoof sticking up from the back of the car. And I look all the way back, and there's half a deer in the back of our car, and it's bloody.
Okay.
And I'm like, Mom, what's up? I'm not, Joe, here's the deal. I'm still not surprised.
You're not shocked?
Nope. I'm not. I do want an explanation.
So what happened? Where did that deer come from?
I'm thinking to myself, I'm so glad that I did not have a play date, somebody coming over with me, because that would have been messed up. But anyhow, I'm like, Mom, what's the deer in the back of the car? And it's like, honestly, a normal mother-daughter would be like, Mom, why did you bring Aunt Judy? You know what I mean? But nope, there's a dead deer. And she's like, oh, I just found that on the side of the road. I pulled over because it was lying on the side of the road, and it, you know what? It was still warm. So now, Thursday night is solved. And I'm like, but there's only half a deer. I'm not even at Thursday night yet. I'm still trying to figure out why there's only half a deer. And she's like, half a deer, I know, and I got the best part. Can you imagine? There was a farmer who pulled up behind me, and we decided to split it because he had the tools to chop it up. And he has no idea I got the best part. And here she is like high-fiving herself for getting the best venison off the deer.
So what happened on Thursday night?
Well, we were having one of our big dinners at the Brzezinski house with ambassadors and senators and foreign policy
experts.
This
never happened in my house, by the way, but
go
ahead.
These are wonderful, wonderful events where my parents would engage in long, interesting conversations, often rooted in debate or disagreement over world policy, financial policy, politics, whatever. And my mom is serving this deer, the venison. And everyone, now we did everything ourselves. So my brothers and I would take coats. Then I would go work in the kitchen and pass out food on these beautiful Czech plates. And I'm passing out like the salads and stuff like that. When people are chomping away on the venison, Pamela Harriman is there. She is
Yeah. So Pamela Harriman, for those who might be too young to remember, she was the grand dame of...
Yeah.
of Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
She was the center of the Washington social scene for the 70s
and
80s.
So she was there, and everyone's eating, and someone said, oh, my gosh, Mrs. Brzezinski, this is, everyone loves it. And they're like, who is your caterer? And I literally freeze. I literally freeze mid-pass of a plate to somebody.
You know what's coming.
Because I know what's coming. You want to know what's
and
coming?
And it's not going to be good.
It's the truth. My mom, that's the disconnect, and I can feel it coming 1,000 miles away. She goes, oh, I don't have a caterer. I do everything myself. And I got this on the side of the road. The entire room fell silent. You could feel like,
hum.
And then Pamela Harriman, without skipping a beat, spit it out. And
sort of slow motion. Now, this seems like one of those moments.
Like I was,
as a child, you look back and you got Pamela Harriman at the end of the table, the center of Washington society, and she is spitting out the venison, and it just slowly tumbles over and over and over, feeling gravity's pull down toward the table.
And I think now you understand what I mean by disconnect. And that was one of those moments where I could see in real time the disconnect between my mom and like everything else in my world. But it was okay. I mean, it ended up in the paper to this day. To this day, my mother doesn't understand what was wrong with it. It was a good use of very good venison.
Well, you don't waste.
You don't waste good meat.
You don't waste good meat. She came from Czechoslovakia. They had to
escape Hitler.
Escaped Hitler in 37, 38.
For a year.
Yeah, she went to Britain. She was during the Battle of Britain.
How can you blame her?
She's one of the little kids that got sent out and mm-hmm. had a rough year.
Stayed in an orphanage.
Out in an orphanage. So this was This is just what you did. You did.
Yes.
It's kind of like my grandma in rural Georgia, grew mm-hmm. up in the Great Depression. I never once saw her leave anything on her plate.
Exactly.
You just didn't do it because the mindset was, we don't know when we're going to eat again.
There was one other traumatic moment. I'll be quick.
Oh, what's that?
While we're on the subject of deer.
Yeah.
So my brother shot a deer, and it was hanging off our tree, because we usually gut them and then hang them
up. Now, wait a second. You were in McLean.
Yes, I know.
That's sort of the hamlet.
McLean Hamlet right nearby.
Hamlet of Washington, D.C., where Colin Powell mm-hmm. and Dick Cheney and you name it, everybody that's anybody back in the 70s and 80s and 90s lived.
We had chickens, ducks, horses, and we hunted deer and turkey, and we often had deer. I would come home and there'd be a deer hanging
off
the tree.
So Colin Powell would be driving past the house and see deer hanging off the tree.
It's a very secluded home. Beautiful.
Oh, of course it is.
Actually, what's happening with the home, it's now becoming a beautiful dog park, is another story.
Mm-hmm.
But I would come home from school and there'd be a deer hanging from the tree. And I would prepare myself when I would come out with friends. I'd look out of the left of my eye just to see if there was a deer there so I could warn them.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
There was no deer this one day
when I
came home from school with Sarah Height, who was the coolest girl in school. She had like feathered hair like Farrah Fawcett.
So this was a big day.
Yeah, she had the comb in the back pocket.
I mean, let's
blue
face
eyeshadow.
It, from what you tell me, you and I, we were both kind of dorks.
But this was my moment.
Growing up, but this was your moment because you got, unlike I never had the cool kids coming to my house, you had the cool kids coming over to your house.
The most popular girl in school came home, Sarah.
You've got to be excited about
this. So she comes in and I'm like, thank God there's no deer. This is a good thing. And now the house is obviously very mm-hmm. messy and my mom's art is everywhere. And I'm just going to go straight up to my room. But Sarah.
Just get her past your mom as fast as possible because it's really.
No kitchen.
It's probably the safest thing for your social standing.
Yeah. And so I get in, we're at the house. My mom's saying hi. And Sarah's like, can I use the bathroom? I have to go to the bathroom so bad.
Right.
And I'm like, the bathroom's right by the kitchen. So go ahead.
Go ahead, Sarah.
And it was freezing out. And so all of a sudden, Sarah goes to the bathroom. There is this pause as she's making her way there. And I'm just kind of mm-hmm. waiting for my hopefully best friend in the whole world. And then I hear a blood-curdling scream as if there had been a murder.
What happened?
My mom had a deer that she wanted to, she had taken it off the tree, dragged it mm-hmm. into the house, was going to chop it up and skin it, which she does in the kitchen.
All right.
But then she got sidetracked. So she dragged it into that bathroom, put it in the tub, opened the window. And since it was below freezing outside, that bathroom was her temporary refrigerator.
Well, that's nice. This is a Polish refrigeration. Well, actually, Czechoslovakian refrigerated.
End of the friendship right there.
That was end.
That's it.
Now, I understand, though, because I know you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it'll shock people. I may have heard this story one time before. There's so many stories, like the Pamela Harriman story. I wasn't sure about that. I wasn't sure about a Deng Xiaoping story or this Sarah story. You know, Jimmy Carter told me at your father's funeral that everything about you running over Menachem Begin and you spilling caviar.
Those are for another day.
Those are for another day. But Jimmy Carter basically confirmed all of this without me mm-hmm. even asking. Just talking about how you almost destroyed U.S. foreign policy
another
across
day,
the globe
Joe.
By
An-
yourself as
day.
A 10-year-old girl. But this Sarah Hyde, you say she actually reached out to you later and laughed about how.
Yeah.
The cool kids, they're finally talking to you. When do you think they'll start talking to
me?
Well,
they're talking to me when I'm like 50 years old. I really needed her when I was 13,
I know. Well, it never works that way. But so. I'm still hoping that maybe before I turn 60, some of the cool kids will start talking to me. I don't know. But you know what? I don't need the cool kids. I don't need the cool kids. I got Mika and I've got you. And I want to thank you so much for being with us on the podcast. Barry Gibb, he's going to be with us early next week. Got a lot more coming your way. Can't wait to talk to you then. Have a great weekend.